This is the Alembic Files, and Eric the Blacksmith is on the other end of this phone, and this means it's Phantasms of Freedom, number 15. And, yeah, you've been loaded for bear lately, Eric, and, you know, thanks for coming back, but you've had unbridled enthusiasm about the last couple of shows, and I think that's because, and you're going to tell us, that you probably hit upon some real diamonds in the rough with regard to old books and information.
Yeah, I have. Hi, Al. Thanks. It's good to be back. I found a very interesting book. Geez, I've got so many things on the plate tonight. I'm going to try to have some semblance of a, you know, an almost, let's see, almost contained train wreck here.
Hey, listen, remember who you're talking to. It's okay with me.
Yeah, you know, series of books that you had that covered the Vatican was such a comprehensive list that most people who are unfamiliar with it are really going to be blown away when they first see it because of just the sheer number of volumes. And I did find a book. I don't know if it's in this list, but it's called Washington in the Lap of Rome.
I'm going to stop you right there only to tell you that it is in the list, and I did find it, and I'm going to put that link up because that book is, I believe it's on archive.org. It doesn't matter. I'll get it. But I also sent you the PDF, so it is there for everyone to read. So believe me, if you go into that, that's accessible to everyone.
Good. It was written in 1888 by Justin D. Fulton. And I will read a section or two from it.
Okay.
To Americans. Let's see. And some of it, I guess because it's OCR, some of it didn't take.
That's okay. But let me ask you something, too, because we both know why. But how are you framing that with regard to what you've been doing with Phantasms of Freedom? What are we going to find here that's important?
Well, the early warnings about the Romish influence, and I do have some information on the income tax.
Okay.
And basically it does tie in to the control of this country by Rome and the Jesuits. And you had somebody here in the 1880s coming right out and talking about the United States being under control of the Romish influence.
Okay.
Let's see.
And, of course, he's not the only one because Morse was talking about it at that time, and so was Chinnicky.
That's correct.
I mean, so the point is when we did the bibliography, we didn't slap everything up there just to have a lot of titles. I mean, we've been through all of them, and there's some that we just decided to deselect because it's not strong. And people who are looking for it to not to be the truth are going to take whatever they can find as the weakest link and say, okay, see, this whole thing is garbage. So you have to be careful along those lines. But, you know, what we put up there, which goes back as far as the 1840s or 50s, I mean, here you have accounts for over a century and a half at this stage, that are you know, resonating with each other, you know, unbeknownst to the authors.
That's true. This book here, it says, to Americans who will, and I can't, it just says AM, I'm not sure what it means or what it says, in throttling Jesuitism, in uncoiling the serpent encircling the capital of the United States, and in taking Washington out of the lap of Rome, that a free church and a free school and a free state may make the great republic the glory of the world. And it has chapters here. And Washington in the Lap of Rome, this was the preface, has been written to call the attention of the American people to the great trust which has been betrayed and to the great work which devolves upon them. It uncovers facts which will bring the blush of shame to the cheek of the real Republican and fill his soul with indignation. 15,000 department clerks are under the surveillance of Rome. If it be not true, as is charged, that a private wire runs from the White House in Washington to the Cardinal's Palace in Baltimore, and that every important question touching the interests of Romanism in America is placed before his eye. Before it becomes a public act, it is true that the cardinal is a factor in politics. Romanism is the dominant power in the capital of the United States. Lincoln, Grant, and Arthur withstood it and suffered the consequences. The power is unseen. It is shadowy. It inhabits the air and infects it. Romanism is the malaria of the spiritual world. It stupefies the brain, deadens the spirit, and sears the conscience as with a hot iron. It comes, as did the tempter, with gifts in its hands of rule, of power, and of wealth to all who will fall down and worship it. And, of course, it goes on. But I haven't seen, besides what the Informer did, something that would come right out and say, okay, the Vatican is the big dog in the meat house. The Vatican runs everything, which is pretty much what the Informer laid out for us. And if somebody didn't come across that information, at least this is how I see it, if somebody didn't come across that information, but would get a general idea of just how powerful this entity is, all they would have to do is look at that list of books and to see what this guy here is saying about the Vatican or the Jesuits running Washington. And he'd say, what? What the hell are you talking about? I mean, that was my reaction for quite a long time.
Well, the problem is here that, and I try to separate this not to save bruising by people who don't like what we're talking about, but I'm not talking about Roman Catholicism. What people have to understand,
that's correct,
is
it's
that
not
we're talking
about the Catholics.
Right, we're talking about the Vatican, which has always been a global entity. They've always been involved, no matter how vast or small the world was during their time. They were the ones that were pretty much running the show. And again, you know, I don't give a pass to Protestants or anything else. I mean, you know, we can look at Martin Luther and find out, you know, just how unsaintly he was. Although he's held in high esteem by Protestants, and of course he's the breakaway person, if you will, that began Protestantism. And of course you have a sect called Lutheranism, which I grew up in. But I mean, when I look back at what some of the things that Luther wrote, you know, my point is he's no better than anyone else either. So we go back to the Vatican, Rome, as a geopolitical power for its entire history. However, when they started to falter because they no longer had a navy, and they needed to conscript, obviously, fighting forces for their purposes, it was the Jesuits in around 1822 that took over the Vatican, though the Vatican resisted the Jesuit advances, and it finally succumbed to them and acceded to what they wanted to do. And that begat a new era of the Vatican's power spreading across the globe. So you have we have a resurgence in 1820s where the Vatican now is completely infused with new blood and new purpose, and now goes on another, if we will, global crusade, but disguised as evangelism.
Yes. And I look at the number of authors that wrote such strong language, and there obviously had to be something to what they were saying. And it was just dozens and dozens and dozens of people. And, of course, tonight, you know, what happened 50 years ago today, and did not JFK, sometime prior to his demise, give a speech to, correct me if I'm wrong here, the Cardinals Association, where he all but bitch-slapped the Vatican and said, we're not going to kowtow to some religious entity across the puddle.
All right, we have a couple of things here. Are you talking about what can be found on YouTube in 59 when he was starting to stump for the presidency and still a senator in Massachusetts?
Correct.
Yeah, right. I forget what the body to which he was speaking, but I think it was ecclesiastical in some senses. And, yeah, that was kind of like, oh, really? And if people wonder, like, well, he's a Catholic, why would he get off by his own? And that's because they eat their young.
And, oh, yeah.
And we talked about that, that, you know, what, a week or two earlier, before Kennedy's assassination, the supposed Catholic brothers, Diem, over in Vietnam got rubbed out. So you got to wonder what was going on there. Now, we've talked about this before. You got to wonder it was a semi-coup, somewhat. And at least the end of the Vietnam era of a certain particular, under a certain aegis, if you will. Because this guy passed off from Eisenhower to Kennedy. And I think Kennedy wanted to get out. I mean, there's all kinds of stories about, no, we wanted to, expand, who knows at this time. But things were different when Kennedy took office. And things continued. Let's face it, Vietnam went on for another 11 years. So could it possibly be that JFK wanted to get out of there and the people who were making money from this war didn't want that to happen, which is it's an absolute reflection of what happened with Abraham Lincoln killing the beef or cotton business that everybody's making money off when he wanted to end the Civil War too soon. That's a parallel nobody really talks about. But it's got to do with economics. And as you know, Eric, it's always about the money.
Indeed.
And I'm sorry, but, thank you for broaching that. For brooking that, but go ahead.
Yeah, on page 15, he talks about plans of mice and men gang off the glee. It is not the first time that Jehovah, by storm and rain, has disconcerted and broken up the plans of Rome. Twice this was done in the days of Napoleon, when, but for them, he would have been master of the world, but it came and piled his ships on the lee shore and buried sailor and soldier in a watery grave. Once this same terrible result was reached when Philip II of Spain sent his armada of ships to crush out the power of Elizabeth, England's noble queen. In our own land, a storm helped us when hope had almost died out of the heart. In the old South Church, Boston, there stood up a man of God to pray. Liberty was imperiled. A fleet was on its way from the old world to the new, bearing soldiers determined to make an end of the attempt to kindle on the shores of this western world the light of a newborn hope. The wind that gently lifted a lock of his white hair from his brow was but the touch of that tempest that engulfed the fleet in ruin and saved the country from peril. That being who permitted the persecution of the children of Israel until Pharaoh was beside himself with wrath and egotism, and as if to defy God, followed the people in their march to Canaan until the floods environed him when God withdrew the unseen walls which held back the sea and permitted the waters to break forth, smiting horsemen and riders with the wrath of God until chariot wheel crushed into chariot wheel and Pharaoh's host, with all their pride and pomp, sank into the bottom of the sea as a stone. And it goes on. And I noticed that even back then, there was this concept of America being a God-breathed country, which is what I read in that excerpt.
Right.
And it was even back then, probably even more so. And, of course, the prose was just so much more flowery and... much more ornate. And it seems that the further back you go, the more ornate and flowery it gets.
Well,
but this is a fascinating book, and to be honest, I haven't really. I mean, I've sort of blazed through it real quick. I haven't really sat down and read it, but it looks like a fascinating read, and it is a warning. It has a lot of detail. It's about, let's see, how many pages? It's about 150. I have a PDF that's about 150 pages.
Yeah, and mine is 149. Point well taken. Right, same thing.
Okay.
And I would tell folks also, if you're listening to this, and since the link for this PDF will be up there, if you choose to download it, you can read along with Eric. And if you're trying to find a spot, and like, for instance, when he just continued to read, just do a find word, and I hit tempest because that was one of the key words that you were just speaking about. And you'll pick it up right away, so you can read it along with us. But I wanted to bring you back to one thing, and please, hold your space there where you're going, because what's really important is, and this is something that's not spoken about much at all, and in your earlier excerpt reading, it talked about Baltimore and the Cardinal. Now, there was a couple of things going on at the time. The Cardinal that was in, the head Cardinal that was in Baltimore was Wiget. And Wiget was a handler of John Surratt. And
that's correct.
You can, yeah, you can believe that they went ahead and they coached Surratt. And Baltimore, by the way, was a Jesuit stronghold, perhaps the most Jesuit city in America. And Maryland in itself is a very Catholic-founded place. And that's one of the reasons why Lincoln was always in peril when he would ride the train from D.C. anywhere north of Baltimore, because they were laying for him. So they had to go through all kinds of ambuscades, if you will, so that he, in fact, would live both on the round trip, rather. And then also there's another thing going on, and that is something that Charles Wilcox brought out. Very interesting. And I think he has that chronicled in his book. And that is the cardinal that I think the Vatican wished to install in America as the head poobah was a Cardinal Antonelli. I don't know if you came across that name at all.
No.
All right. And Antonelli was probably the Vatican's man in the United States. And that still goes on to this day. And unofficially, it is believed that the cardinal who sits in St. Patrick's Cathedral runs the show among the cardinals in the United States, and that would be Dolan now. Probably the most famous slash infamous New York cardinal was Spellman. Hence, they called Vietnam Spelly's War.
Okay.
So
I have an interesting link up here, and I will include it when I send you the notes and
okay.
stuff. RogerJNorton.com/Lincoln74.html, and it has a series, it lists a series of, quote, conspiracy theories, unquote, behind Lincoln's assassination. And, of course, it was a conspiracy. What's that old saying? The only conspiracy is...
the only conspiracy history you don't know about.
Correct. So we have about maybe 7 or 8 theories, and one of them... And you know, here's another thing, Al. The parallels between the assassination of Lincoln and the assassination of JFK were just downright creepy, spooky, weird. If you look at the numerology involved,
oh, yeah.
Not so much astrology, but numerology, the names, almost just some real Twilight Zone, you know, insert Twilight Zone theory here, as Theo would say, or insert Twilight Zone theme, excuse me. That, you know, would be playing. But theory number 5, the Roman Catholic Church was behind Lincoln's assassination. In 1886, an ex-priest by the name of Charles Chinnicky,
mm-hmm.
and there's a photo of him or a picture, wrote a book titled 50 Years in the Church of Rome, which portrayed the assassination of Lincoln as a Catholic grand conspiracy. Chinnicky maintained that Jefferson Davis had offered $1 million if someone would, quote, kill the author of the bloodshed, unquote. Chinnicky wrote that the money could be offered, but that, quote, the Jesuits alone would select the assassins, train them, and show them a crown of glory in heaven, unquote. Booth was the tool of the Jesuits. He was corrupted and directed by the Vatican. In 1906, Chinnicky said, quote, the president, Abraham Lincoln, was assassinated by the priests and the Jesuits of Rome, unquote. In 1856, Lincoln had defeated Chinnicky in court. Chinnicky had quarreled with his bishop and then was sued for slander by one of the bishop's friends, the bishop himself having nothing to do with the complaint. A morals charge was also involved. The case was heard May 20th to the 22nd, 1856, in Urbana, Illinois. Lincoln arranged for a compromise settlement, but Chinnicky interpreted the settlement as a victory over the church. He felt some Jesuits held Lincoln responsible for the settlement. In 1897, Thomas M. Harris, a member of the 1865 Military Commission, wrote a book entitled Rome's Responsibility for the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Other books that involve the Roman Catholic Church in Lincoln's assassination include Democracy Under Siege, The Jesuits' Attempt to Destroy the Popular Government of the United States.
That's Wilcox's book, in fact.
Okay, yes, The True Story of Abraham Lincoln's Death by C.T. Wilcox,
yep.
and The Suppressed Truth About the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln by Burke McCarty.
McCarty, yep.
1924. McCarty's opening sentence was, quote, "In all the bloody history of the papacy, perhaps in no one man as in Abraham Lincoln was there concentrated such a multitude of reasons for his annihilation by that system," unquote. An inquiry into the assassination of Abraham Lincoln by Emmett McLaughlin was published in 1963. Among other points, McLaughlin maintained that the majority of American Catholics were in favor of slavery and opposed to Lincoln. The author said that the totalitarian papacy considered Lincoln a major enemy, and that the church for centuries had, quote, "been involved in numerous instances of the forcible removal of heads of state whom it condemned," unquote.
All right.
And I just want to say that for people out there who are listening and saying that all this is hogwash, just do us a favor and just check it out for yourself. Don't take our word for it. Crack some books, go online, spend some time, slip your minds in the neutral, and check it out.
All right. Now I'm going to tell you the history with people as we know it. And I say we because for the most part, it was Theo and myself. Eric John Phelps was very integral in our understanding of this whole situation. But Phelps literally just got so strange that we had to just like walk away from him. And the fact that he may have had that, well, that he became what he became. Let's just put it that way.
Now, this is Eric John Phelps now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, something took place with him. Like, you know, and I'm not going to say he's anything like Alex Jones, but it was one of these cases, as it was with Alex Jones, that suddenly, all you know, you got a different mindset and a different tack that was going on, different from the way each person was beforehand. And I would say that it came in with the injection of money into Phelps, and also with Jones, but with Phelps, all of a sudden, he had a five-day-a-week show. His website became, like, you know, absolutely animated three-ring circus, which I'm not saying is bad because it was so really stodgy. So there's something that took place, but with that came also a more and more kind of racist message, and to the point where it's like, no, we can't do this anymore, and we, you know, we don't like who you're hanging around with. However, a lot of people would like to trash all he did because of what he turned into. But that doesn't vitiate what he had done. But the point I try to bring across was Phelps is only one person who has written on this. And, you know, he may be the one that's most prominent at this time, arguably. But, you know, no, I'm sorry. You know, the messenger may have gone a little bit south, but the message was good. A long story short, I mean, Wilcox probably has been the voice of reason because of where he's kept himself without getting into, like, you know, these pitched social commentaries and such. I know it's a long way around, but one of the things that I want to do is, did I read this with you ever at all about Kennedy's speech in 61 at the Waldorf Astoria?
I don't think so.
Well,
I don't remember it. Let me put it that way.
Right.
But
here's the
thing.
The urban legend around Kennedy was that he said certain things in November in New York at Columbia University that supposedly portended his death. That is completely, utterly false. When I went looking to corroborate that years ago, and I went through the New York Times, you know, back issues and microfilm and such, did not happen. He only spoke twice in New York, and the one time that he made any kind of what you might call provocative statements was on April 27th, 1961, before the American Newspaper Publishers Association at the Waldorf Astoria. Now, remember, this was only days after the Bay of Pigs blew up in his face. And I'm just going to read one short paragraph, and you tell me what this is about, because people have told me, he's talking about the Russians at the time. If he was talking about the Russians, he would have said so, because the Russians were the bad guys, who were our enemies. He would have said it. He didn't speak about any one nation, and here we go. "For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. And lastly, its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War, in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match. So, I mean, there he says, we're opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy. But, it, you know, he does not say it's a nation because it's not a nation. So who would fit that bill? You know, I have...
For me, it's that little nation state in Rome.
Yeah.
And here's one reason I believe that as well. For one thing, that was, to me, that speech was to Kennedy, or for Kennedy, what the Gettysburg Address was.
That's
for
right.
Lincoln.
Exactly. Very good.
It was short. It was pithy. It was to the point. It was concise. It was a textbook example of brevity being the soul of wit, or at least in this point, or at least in this case, wisdom.
Well, let me ask you though something, Eric. Was it your understanding? I mean, the speech alone is somber. You know, there's no gloating. There's no drum pounding. You know, no chest beating. No baboon posturing about how the North is going to kick the South's ass. Do you suspect that during that time that he was in Gettysburg and saw the remnants of the carnage, that he wrote this, and do you think it signaled to everyone that he did not have the stomach for prosecuting this war any further?
Absolutely. He saw all the carnage. He saw the just total destruction. And I think he finally had his fill.
Do you think at that time then, with that speech, that he signed his death warrant?
I would have to say it's very, very strong likelihood that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and the parallel that you made then between his speech and what Kennedy said, I think that what Kennedy said was definitely a shot across the bow of the Vatican.
Yes, and here's why I think, Al, he wasn't really talking about the Russians. Because the Russians were, he says, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. The Russians were proud of their armies by day.
Of course.
They would have the big parades in Red Square with the missiles and the tanks and the military equipment and the half-treads and everything else.
Right there,
to me, that little excerpt, those words there, rule out the Soviets or the Russians.
Yeah, it rules out any nation. And I think what also supports that is when he says... where's the conscript word?
I have it in front of me. Let me see here.
Oh, okay. It says it is a system that has,
right.
Which has conscripted vast human and material resources. Conscripted means you don't own them. You gather them together. And he said it's a system. He didn't say it was a nation that did this.
Correct.
All right. So, I mean, do you have that speech in front of you now?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
VaticanNewWorldOrder.blogspot.com.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what I'll do also, it should be apropos, I keep saying these things, then I have to ask you later, what did I say? I'll put that speech up in a link with Kennedy, because
okay.
I have it in the Word doc.
Okay.
So, all right, so we're on the same page. And here's a parallel that really isn't drawn for obvious reasons. What people don't know about was that there was a cotton for beef deal between the North and the South. Even though they were fighting one another, the North was willing to give the South, or the Confederacy, beef because, thank you, the Union armies went down and killed all the cattle. On the other hand, Europe was absolutely champing at the bit to get cotton, because all of a sudden this cotton export from the United States stopped, and Britain was highly insulted because they had to use what they called inferior cotton from India. So
that's correct.
So to keep Britain happy and to keep the businessmen humming on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line, it was agreed, and Lincoln knew it, that beef would be sent to the South, cotton would be taken from the North, it would be processed and then sent to Britain. And not only that, but there were people making money in the governments of both the North and the South, and even Lincoln's own party, some of the close people to him, were in on this deal. And they met the legations from the North and the South to discuss the beef-cotton deal in Montreal. And that's interesting because that is French-Canadian Canada, and that's where the Jesuits had a stronghold.
Very strong Catholic and Jesuit presence.
Yeah, I mean, the Jesuits that came out of there that tried to proselytize the Indians, Tecumseh and the boys, all through the upper Mississippi Valley. And it also explains why that there is a huge enclave in what's normally thought as Protestant states in both Wisconsin and Minnesota. So, and that's a direct result of not only immigration from Europe, but also the proselytization that took place with the Jesuits. So there you go.
And my feeling is that when Kennedy made his covert conspiracy speech, and when Lincoln made his Gettysburg address, my feeling is there was no chest pounding, but I think both men in their hearts had a quiet disgust that was just overtaking them with what they'd seen.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I think it's a leading question, but I think it has to be asked. And that is, again, money was at the root. There was a lot of money being made under the table in both wars. I would say this. Lincoln, for as much as he is lionized on one hand by history books and any kind of a mainstream reminisce, has also been vilified to no end by those who are pro-Jesuit, which would include Tom DiLorenzo, who has been a huge castigator of Lincoln on the Lou Rockwell site, which, you know, could not go to hell fast enough.
How many times does he have to kick the corpse?
I mean, stop already. Okay, we got it. And somewhere between DiLorenzo and those who lionize Lincoln, you know, lies the truth. I get that. The point is, Lincoln and Kennedy both knew the way things were. As far back as Lincoln's presidency, he understood what intrigues were involved in being president and that you are not your own man. And should you choose to try to be so, well, you risk the consequences. Both men did. But let's remember one thing. Neither man was Lily White. They both knew the dirty business they were getting into.
They were both Turks, but I do think that their realizations and their disgust, I mean, I'm not lionizing them or putting them up on pedestals by any means, but I do feel that they did have redemption.
Yeah.
And what led to their redemption also led to their demise.
If you stray from the plan, if you go ahead and start freelancing and becoming roguish, you're going to get killed. And what's interesting also in the first excerpt you wrote, it talked about paying the price for bucking the Vatican, and included in that was Lincoln, Garfield, and Arthur. And I'm like,
yes.
What? Arthur?
Chester Arthur.
But remember also that involved in this whole deal was Garfield. Arthur became Arthur became president because Garfield got whacked by another lone gunman. What was Garfield's sin? And then, of course, 20 years later, you get McKinley getting whacked by a lone gunman. What was his sin? I mean, can you imagine lone crazy gunmen being almost 100% in their attempts at assassination? Supposed lone nut jobs? Give me a break.
It seems to be, it's almost the second American pastime is being a lone gunman, a very successful one at that. You know, I was looking also at something involving Vietnam, and I have mixed feelings about Avril Manhattan, but like Eric John Phelps, you know, his work shouldn't be vitiated because of any bum steers that he put out. He was a British journalist, and I guess he was with the BBC for a number of years. I think he wrote about 15 or he wrote at least a dozen books about the Catholic Church and world affairs. And he did have a book called Vietnam, Why Did We Go? He tells us, quote, the political and military origin of the War of Vietnam has been described with millions of written and spoken words. Yet nothing has been said about one of the most significant forces which contributed to its promotion, namely the role played by religion, which in this case means the part played by the Catholic Church and by her diplomatic counterpart, the Vatican. Their active participation is not mere speculation. It is an historical fact as concrete as the presence of the U.S. or the massive guerrilla resistance of Asian communism. The activities of the last two have been scrutinized by thousands of books, but the former has never been assessed, not even in a summarized form. The Catholic Church must be considered as a main promoter in the origin, escalation, and prosecution of the Vietnamese conflict. From the very beginning, this religious motivation helped set in motion the avalanche that was to cause endless agonies in the Asiatic and American continents. The price paid was immense, thousands of billions of dollars, the mass dislocation of entire populations, political anarchy, military devastation on an unprecedented scale, the disgrace upon the civilized world, the loss of thousands upon thousands of young Asian and American lives. Last but not least, the wounding, mutilation, and death of hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children. The tragedy of Vietnam will go down in history as one of the most pernicious deeds of the contemporary alliance between politics and organized religion. And let's see here. He does talk about. Okay, this is what I wanted to originally read here. Ho Chi Minh began before World War II to maneuver for a communist Vietnam. He received help from the U.S. against the Japanese, but used that aid to consolidate his load on the highlands of Tonkin. In August 1945, he marched into Hanoi and set up the Provisional Government of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. A master strategist, he cooperated in the transplanting of nearly a million Catholic North Vietnamese into the South. After the election of Pope John XXIII in 1958 and the turn of the Vatican from the Cold War towards cooperation with Marxism, Ho Chi Minh made a secret deal with Pope John, which eventually led to full control of the country by the North. President, let's see here, NGO, Ngo Dinh Diem of South Vietnam was a practicing Catholic who ruled South Vietnam with an iron fist. He was a genuine believer in the evil of communism and the uniqueness of the Catholic Church. He had originally been planted in the presidency by Cardinal Spellman and Pope Pius XII. He transformed the presidency into a virtual Catholic dictatorship, ruthlessly crushing his religious and political opponents. Many Buddhist monks committed suicide by fire, burning themselves alive in protest against his religious persecution. As a side note, I do recall seeing some of those burnings on TV. They were filmed, some of them. His discriminatory persecution of non-Catholics, particularly Buddhists, caused the disruption of the government and mass desertions of the army. This eventually led to U.S. military intervention in South Vietnam. In this terrorization, he was aided by his two Catholic brothers, the chief of the secret police and the Archbishop of Hue. I don't know if people realize just how many tentacles this thing has spread all over this planet.
Well, I tell you what, how about if I knock your eyeballs out with this? You mentioned Burt McCarty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the book was The Suppressed Truth About the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Correct.
And what year was that published?
Oh, let me see. Was
1924?
That, I believe so. I don't know if I have that back. Let's see if I can get that back up here.
And I don't know if I read this before. I haven't had a deja vu like in decades. I think I'm having one right now. But when your mind
might have been, it might have been 24.
I think you said 24.
I believe I did. Yeah.
All right. Here's what she wrote. Now dig this, okay? This is in the introduction. It says introduction, a conspiracy of silence on the death of Abraham Lincoln by the original author Burke McCarty. But this is really rich. Now remember, she wrote this in 24, or even earlier if it was published in 24. Dig this. She says, the next step in the Vatican's great scheme is to make war between this country, the U.S., and Japan. after the latter country has been placed under the full dominance of the Jesuits.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, really?
Yeah. And it goes on. It says, the priests, monks, and nuns of the Roman Church have been pouring into Japan from all over the world now for many years with that purpose in view. The writer was told by a Christian Japanese minister in charge of a Protestant mission in L.A., in reply to the question as to why the Jesuits, who had been barred for years in Japan, had now been permitted to enter, he answered that the Roman Church had gotten into this country under the guise of Mohammedism, and that after it was well entrenched, threw off its disguise, and his country learned, to its astonishment, that it was to the Roman Church and its monastic orders it had opened its doors. But it gets better. And I won't go on too much with this, but this is something that, again, is chilling. And let me see if I can find it real quick. Hold on. Because this is even more current. Hang with me.
Excuse me while I go pick my eyeballs up.
All right, here we go. Going on, I think this is even earlier. It says, The Tragedy of Quebec, that's a book, written by a Protestant Canadian, exposes the plan in detail, and the facts and figures given by this writer, who has been a close student of this subject for many years, are startling. It would be illumination to the reader who is not familiar with this book to read it. In fact, I didn't even know that was, I got to go check that out. It says, the full plan of extending the Pope's empire on the Atlantic coast will be done by Latinizing our southern states, a process which was begun very early in our history prior to the Civil War.
Holy crap.
Now, the thing that's key here is that we saw this illegal immigration, and I mean, I don't care. You know, this isn't like an anti-Mexican thing. I don't care. The thing is...
Of course not.
You know, illegal immigration.
It doesn't matter. I don't care if they're green with purple no. polka dots. If they're here illegally, they're here illegally.
But I tell you what. I mean, I was involved with some guys on the radio. One was a lawyer who I expected to be above all this. His name was C.J. Saya, I think, from Sarasota. And when we talked about...
Your name to me.
Huh?
I have not heard of him. Name
no, you wouldn't have. But the thing that would struck me was that he went apoplectic about what we were saying about how illegal immigration is not good. And it's like, let me get this straight. I mean, you're such a learned, together guy, you know, just so, like, sagacious. And you're telling me that you can't see through this whole situation, that illegal immigration is never good for any country, especially if it can't handle the influx of people with regard to what jobs, you know, there is in this country. I mean, so the point is, oh, the deal back then was, well, you know, they're doing jobs, that, you know, that Americans don't want to do. You know, yeah, fine. That worked for a little bit. But what we're looking at is corporations fleeing the United States, as they have done since the 70s, outsourcing everything. At the same time that you are diminishing the number of jobs in the United States, you're bringing more people in. Is this like an inverse ratio that doesn't really kind of make a lot of sense? But the thing was, he went nuts as if it was a racist thing I was doing. I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't care if they were Norwegians or Scots or whatever. But, I mean, because they're Latins doesn't mean, you know, that it's a racist situation. It just happens to be that way. And I'm trying to still figure out to this day how this country couldn't protect its borders, which it had done for about, what, 180 years before this.
Yeah.
So, but they got caught up in that whole. I mean, look, are you an American? Are you a Mexican? Are you a Venezuelan? I mean, I don't care if you're Latino or not, but I'm so sick and tired of hearing about, well, I'm an African-American, and I'm a Latin-American. Oh, okay, I'm a Norwegian-American. I mean, will you stop with all this stuff? All right? I mean, you're an American. You decided to stay here. Okay, let's deal with business now, okay? All right. You know, forget the harangue. But the thing is that this situation that we're seeing now is a soft invasion in preparation of a very nasty event. The same thing took place prior to the Civil War, and it was called the Irish Famine, in which the Brits blockaded Ireland, forced males to come out to the north, swelled the ranks of males in the north who were Roman Catholic, and guess what? That was in preparation for a future civil war.
Yes.
And the same thing is happening now. So Bert McCarty nailed it when she said in 24 that they'll achieve this grip of the Vatican in the United States by, quote, Latinizing our southern states. Well, what do you think has happened in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California, and of all places here in wonderful Florida? So here we go. It's for a purpose, and it's not going to be good. But she wrote that in 24. What, did she get lucky, or did she understand something? And also, folks, if you want to go back and check out the history of the Jesuits trying to get into Japan, though it's a fiction novel, it's based on fact, and that's Clavell's Shogun.
That's amazing.
English.
That she would write that.
Because she knew. I mean,
of course she did. Of course she did. It was just like Orwell, a.k.a. Eric Blair, knowing what the script was.
Yeah, exactly, because they had insight to what was going on.
Sure they did. They saw the blueprint, or at least knew what it was. And they wrote, at least they had the wherewithal to write about it. And I think about Kennedy. He wanted to, one of the things that said that, what was it, Executive Order 11110, which was going to basically dismantle the Federal Reserve System. And, you know, there's a good reason to believe that the Federal Reserve, the central bank, is ultimately a creation of the Jesuits. You know, the Constitution of the U.S., what we think of the Constitution being what it is, it still gave the Congress the power to coin money. So if the U.S. Congress coins its own money,
and
we'd have to pay
the
all these – I'm sorry?
And regulates the value.
Regulates the value thereof, correct.
Right.
It wouldn't have to pay all this interest that it was paying. You know, and I do recall the silver certificates. In fact, my wife has a whole pile of those with a $5 bill, the U.S. silver certificate.
Well, you don't
Kennedy
want that to
issued.
Get around. Don't let that information get out there, buddy, because they're worth a whole lot more than $5 these days.
Oh, well, they're a safe deposit box, so they're covered.
Don't say anything. Don't say anything else.
Okay.
Okay. Now,
all right. It's just monopoly money.
I'm sporting with you. But
yeah.
But
he, and you know, he was issuing U.S. government money. It was free of debt. You know, wanted to replace the Federal Reserve dollars, and you know, it was like President Jackson, Andrew Jackson. He wanted to discontinue the central bank, and I do recall somebody saying that. Somebody had two flintlock pistols and they tried to shoot him. And I'm pretty familiar. I have flintlock pistols. I love shooting them. They're just a lot of fun to shoot. And I've competed with them and everything else. And they can certainly be real temperamental and very unpredictable sometimes as far as, you know, ignition and all.
Well, Jackson did, in fact, kill the charter. And there was a wildcat banking that took place until finally it was reassembled again so that the Bank of England would be the primary bank. And his assassin had both his pistols misfire.
Yeah, and so, you know, Kennedy, he incurs the wrath of the Jesuits because he didn't want to be their puppet. He actually wanted to be a president. You know, and there are people say, well, wait a second. I mean, Kennedy was a Catholic. He was the only Catholic president we had. Well, yeah, but, you know, the Jesuits, like you said, they eat their own. They don't give a rat's frig who he was.
Well,
you know, if he wasn't following their orders, man, he was just going to be, you know, he was going to be turned to room temperature.
But, you know, it's a question as to who patterned what after whom. And I say that because, you know, even in the mafia, you may be in the mafia, but if you stray, you're going to get whacked.
That's right.
And it's the same thing here. It's like, yeah, great, you might be a son of the Vatican and all that other stuff, but, you know, you popped off too much. You gave away too much, and you've been recalcitrant, so that we can't allow that to continue. But remember also, when you went back talking about the Federal Reserve and what Congress was charged with, it was unconstitutional for Congress to go ahead and basically outsource the creating of money and the regulating the value thereof to someone else. And they did that. To a private bank, the Federal Reserve, and that was never brought up in court. It was never tried. And that is unconstitutional, and it just got through in 1913. So, you know, and again, with Lincoln, he wanted to issue greenbacks, and the South didn't want them. They basically wanted the money. I mean, they wanted the beef. They don't want the greenbacks. So there's a whole currency thing going on there. And with Kennedy's wanting to get rid of the Federal Reserve, Trudeau very trenchantly believes that was the case, and that was a major nail in Kennedy's coffin. I'm not sure that that wasn't kind of built up a little bit, but of course it was out there as well. Did I think that issue alone would have caused his assassination? No, I don't. I mean, there was too many.
No, but it was part of the. It was one piece of the puzzle. It was probably one of the bigger pieces, but you're right. It wasn't a whole equation. It was part of the equation.
We talked about in Dark Union. It mentions also in Dark Union. Let me say that clearly, so people, if they want to read that book, should. There were four plots against Lincoln. He pissed everybody off. He pissed off the Confederacy for obvious reasons. He pissed off Marylanders who were being treated like Southerners, which they were, but not treated fairly. And they wanted.
Aren't they half-assed Southerners?
Well, let me tell you something. When I heard that, that was spoken by people in Maryland that called themselves that because they were below the Mason-Dixon line. But obviously, they were scapped into being in the Union. And even their economy was plantation, which was more Virginia, my God, than it was Pennsylvania or Vermont, you know.
Right.
So they get drawn, unhappily, into the North. And how crazy – and see, that's the reason why Maryland is such a critical thing. Because Maryland – was heavily Catholic. It was settled by Catholics and Jesuits. All right? I mean, look at all the names of counties there. Anne Arundel, you know, Calverton, Carroll. There's another one. I mean, it's all Catholic. Baltimore was made a Jesuit stronghold. Georgetown section of Washington is a Jesuit stronghold, and that's where Surratt was tried, and it ended in a hung jury, and he walked. Interesting. But you see, even in the beginning of this country, and I don't know, did you see that stuff that Kelly sent around about the very beginnings of D.C., that the owner of the farmland's name was Pope?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And he called the river that went through it, which I think was the Potomac or tributary, called that the Tiber, you know?
That's right.
And the hill that was in on his property called Capitol Hill is also based on, and I can't remember the Latin name, of a hill in Rome. So right from the very beginning, you could say that it was understood by the powers in Europe that they were going to make the capital of this country in that colony known as Maryland.
And you'd mentioned four groups that were PO'd at Lincoln. You were saying that the Confederacy, Maryland, and who were the other two?
The beef for cotton people who were losing money if he stops the war, and a segment of, and I'm going to misspeak about this, but who was the kind of nasty flank of the Republican Party? Was it the Copperheads?
It might have been.
Yeah, and Stevens was ahead.
I believe it was.
Thaddeus Stevens, I mean, they didn't really want him reelected, but they had to live with him because they knew he was electable. So you had, like I said, a faction in his own party. You had the beef or cotton people who were making money on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. You had the Marylanders, and you had the Confederacy. But the thing that's interesting about Lincoln's assassination by Booth was that it served no purpose as far as it was supposed to in the original plots, which were obviously call a cessation to the war. And the three that I, you know, the three or four of them were based on kidnapping, not killing. They just wanted to grab Lincoln, obviously, like in a chess game, and say, okay, we got the king. Now let's talk. So after Appomattox happened, the killing of Kennedy of Lincoln did nothing. So it was a hit. It was a payback. If you know what I'm saying, rather than, I mean, Booth was not a broken-hearted Confederate zealot who couldn't, you know, who hated Lincoln. Not at all. And we talked about this. He was obviously he was an actor. He was in a troop. He was in the North more than anyone else. In fact, he was banging some babe up in New York who was being banged by a Union general.
That's right. Booth was more of a mercenary than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't care. That was a hit, and he was assigned to make that hit.
Yep.
The thing I think is interesting is why Seward was hit. Now, Grant was supposed to be hit also, but Grant decided not to go to the play that night, and instead with his wife went up to see his daughter in Jersey. But why did they hit Seward? Unless it was made to look like it was a vast plot against everyone, when in essence, all they really wanted was Lincoln.
Yeah.
And then you have, what, seven hanged for the, you know, for the killing. And yet, you know, Surratt, the son, got away, though his mother was hanged for the conspiracy to kill Lincoln.
And safely, eventually safely ensconced by the Jesuits in the Vatican.
He was in the Vatican Guard.
And and then also, what was it, the trial was at Loyola? Or in that neck of the woods? So he was tried
in a Jesuitical
stronghold of somewhere.
Yeah, Georgetown, that's what I was saying.
Georgetown, thank you. Yep.
Yeah, and it was a hung jury, and here's what's really interesting. He wrote his memoirs, and he burned them because nobody wanted to read them. Get out of here.
I don't buy that for a minute.
And it also harkens back to when Booth... I'm sorry. Surratt did supposedly burnt his memoirs. But when Booth was fleeing D.C. and had federal agents on his trail, he left a certain section, he left his diary to be found. Now, what that says to me is that there are parties who could be incriminated by what Booth knew in the conspiracy. And I would think Stanton was one of them. So if Booth leaves the diary behind, he's telling Stanton, you got it, don't worry about it, and leave me alone. And we won't even get into what happened in Garrett's barn, because Booth was not shot in Garrett's barn. Stanton takes control of the diary, and then apparently, I forget the number, it was like 17 or 19 pages were ripped out and never accounted for. So Stanton got out of there, you know, squeaky clean, and he definitely was involved in that. In fact, I don't even know if Stanton had any kind of animosity towards Seward, but of course, if that were the case, it makes more sense why they tried to kill Seward, and they did everything but kill this guy. He was bleeding from everywhere, and he lived, and went and bought Alaska.
Yeah, that'll teach him.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at these intrigues that we never hear about, and with Kennedy, who wasn't mad at him as well? He had the mob mad at him. He had Johnson mad at him. He had the oil guys.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, he had the oil guys mad at him. He had Johnson mad at him. He had the mob mad at him because he had to make good for the fact that they threw the election for him up in Chicago.
Ohio, too, I believe.
For Kennedy?
I think so.
I know for Bush, but so... But, I mean, he had a lot of people pissed off at him. So, of course, if he wanted to get rid of the CIA, that's not going to go over well. He hates Hoover. That's not going to go over well. And I think he wanted to abolish the CIA, which I think in the end got him because of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, which they sabotaged. But, again, you know,
I'm going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
And then
I've got an excerpt here from a book, Gene Hill, JFK, The Last Dissenting Witness, Pelican Publishing.
Okay.
Well, while Kennedy was busy shaking hands with all the well-wishers at the airport, Johnson's Secret Service people came over to the motorcycle cops and gave us a bunch of instructions. The darndest thing was that they told us the parade route through Dealey Plaza was being changed. Changed how? Gene Hill asks. It was originally supposed to go straight down Main Street. JB said, but they said for us to disregard that. Instead, we were told to make the little jog on Houston and cut over to Elm. Jean felt her mouth drop open. If you stayed on Main Street, Kennedy might have been completely out of range of whoever was shooting at him. My shooter behind the wooden fence definitely wouldn't have had much chance to hit him from there. JB stared at her with a straight face. Maybe that's why they changed the route, he said bluntly, but that's not all. They also ordered us into the craziest escort formation I've ever seen. Ordinarily, you bracket the car with four motorcycles, one on each fender. But this time, they told the four of us assigned to the president's car, there'd be no forward escorts. We were to stay well to the back and not let ourselves get ahead of the car's rear wheels under any circumstances. I'd never heard of a formation like that, much less ridden in one. But they said they wanted to let the crowds have an unrestricted view of the president. Well, I guess somebody got an unrestricted view of him all right, unquote. And Johnson there are people who think, oh, Johnson took out Kennedy. Nonsense. He was PO'd at Kennedy, and he probably knew what was going on, but I think, you know, it went way above Johnson.
Well, I mean, I think he was complicit.
Yes.
In his death, I mean, in Kennedy's death, but the thing, like we said, I mean, there was a food fight to kill Kennedy. You know, I have my own, I'm going into it now. I mean, I have my own thoughts from what I can glean that Kennedy may have allowed the Bay of Pigs to go on because he knew he had to pay back the mob. The story is that, oh no, the mob really didn't need to go back into Cuba. You don't lose the casinos in Cuba, and say, oh, we got Las Vegas, so that's okay. Sorry. They wanted to get
there's
back.
There's no comparison
in.
Between the two of them, really.
No, there's not. And this, of course, the assertion that, oh no, they didn't need to get back there. Oh yes, they did. And they would have done anything to get inroads back into that area. If Kennedy has to pay them back by going, okay, I'll do it, here's the problem. And that is, again, as we've said, Cuba is, shall we say, an apple in the eye of the Vatican. And people will laugh and go, well, you know, they're communist and they're atheistic. Don't you believe that for a second. In fact, do yourself a favor. Do a search on how many times the Pope has visited the United States, the popes, and do a search on how many times the popes have visited Cuba. Okay? You can call it like they're trying to proselytize a hard case. Forget about it. It's like because that's for a future date. And again, yes. This goes back to us winning the Spanish-American War, which is a joke. It was a war completely of aggression by us. So we take Puerto Rico and the Philippines and we leave Cuba alone. Yeah, all right, I get that.
Did I mention, I probably did mention the, what was it, the Life or the Time cover, where there was actually a photo or an illustration on the cover, it might have been from 1904, of American troops waterboarding a prisoner.
Yeah, I remember that. In fact, I thought that was in conjunction with the torture. Well, there was a really nasty scene, which Mark Twain writes about, of course, nobody knows, about what we did to the Filipinos after we, quote, liberated them, and that included waterboarding. And I think,
yes.
Did you send me an editorial cartoon or a photo, one or the other?
It was, let me see. I think it was both.
All right.
It might have been an editorial cartoon and the cover of the magazine.
There might have been
two separate pictures. I don't remember exactly, but at the very least, it was the cover of that Time issue.
Yeah,
Time or Life, either one of them.
And Eric, boy, that must have been 2 years ago. I mean, that's a while back. I mean, I do remember that because I was struck by it, but I'd forgotten all about it. So, yeah, I do remember.
Yeah, what's old is new again.
Well, you
know, here we are talking about waterboarding today like it never existed.
Yeah,
we were doing it way back then.
Yeah, you know.